From the studios of KPCW in Park City, it's This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about the environment and our connections with it. I'm Nell Larson.
And I'm Chris Cherniak. While he was stationed in Iraq, Lieutenant Colonel Chip Elliott would occasionally call in to KPCW and provide updates on his experiences over there.
Well, Chip is now in town this week and kind enough to stop by today at the studio to talk about what he's doing now, serving as an assistant professor at West Point in the areas of chemistry and environmental science.
Right. We'll talk to Chip about how the Academy is working the concepts of energy and energy systems into the classroom, including the military's use of fossil fuels, solar energy, and lightweight battery packs.
Then, in the second half of the show, we'll speak with Emma Maris. She's the author of The Rambunctious Garden, and we'll be speaking with her about her book and her view on conservation in our current era, the Anthropocene. What does pristine and what does wild really mean in 2014?
All of that and some news about my visit last week to MetTech, the electronic waste recycling place.
Last week's guest on the show.
Right. So I'll give you a little update on what I experienced there. Also, we'll talk a little bit about tonight's air quality panel at Swanner Eco Center.
That's right. 7 p.m.
And if we have some time, we'll give you a little update on the bad air in Paris and the attempts they made to try to address that. With a driving ban, how did that go?
We'll see how that compares to our efforts here in Utah.
That's right. Of course.
That's right. You can join in on today's discussion by posting your questions or comments to our Facebook page, the KPCW This Green Earth, and you can always email us at thisgreenearth@kpcw.org.
The environment, our connections with it, and impacts upon it. It's This Green Earth, and it all gets started right after these words from our underwriters. Stay tuned.
Park City Restore is grateful for the many hands that have made it successful. Your gift of time means more affordable housing services are available locally through Habitat for Humanity. Plus, volunteering at the Restore gives you a first look at the amazing treasures donated for resale. Learn how you can get involved at habitat-utah.org. Click on the big yellow volunteer button. Habitat for Humanity of Summit and Wasatch Counties is a nonprofit organization.
Experience the ride of a lifetime on the Comet Bobsled Ride and Rocket Skeleton Ride at the Utah Olympic Park. Take a thrilling ride down the entire length of the 2002 Olympic track, ripping through 15 turns and reaching speeds up to 80 miles per hour on the Winter Comet Bobsled Ride. The Rocket Skeleton Ride offers the solo adventure of shooting headfirst down the last five turns of the track. Reservations required. Details and restrictions are available online at utaholympiclegacy.com. Utah Olympic Park is a nonprofit organization dedicated to providing sport and recreation opportunities.
Welcome back to This Green Earth, a weekly talk show on environmental issues and concepts of sustainability. I'm Chris Cherniak, co-host Nell Larson here, and in the studio, our first guest. He is Lieutenant Colonel Chip Elliott. He is a assistant professor of chemistry and environmental science, I guess, Chip, at the U.S. Military Academy in West Point. We want to thank you for taking the time to join us before you hit the slopes this morning,
I
assume.
Thank you very much for having me on.
Let me get your mic up there. Okay. Now, like we said in the intro, you were in Iraq in 2006-2007, correct?
I was. I went over as a team leader for a small team of American officers and non-commissioned officers to train up an Iraqi transportation unit, essentially from scratch. And so in the process of training them, we spent a lot of time out on the roads of Iraq, interacting with the American units out there that were conducting logistics convoys and everything else.
Right.
And what we saw was just massive 100-plus truck convoys of fuelers and cargo trucks carrying water north to support the war effort in country. And then, of course, the escort effort of American soldiers in gun trucks and other armored vehicles to support those convoys and to prevent them from being destroyed by the insurgents was really a massive effort.
Okay, so let's spend a few minutes talking about fuel and water. I mean, give us a sense of how much fuel, and this is diesel, typically.
Largely. J-P-8 is usually what we use, but it's similar to diesel in terms
so,
of.
So fuel was being consumed not just for transportation, but it was also a source of energy.
Absolutely.
Okay.
So to provide power for the soldiers for their quality of life and for their work, we essentially used diesel generators because they're quick, easy to set up, and you know the fuel's generally available in theater. And so to provide power for the soldiers, they set up these generators. And it's interesting to note, very little of that fuel is actually used for tactical operations compared to the amount that's used to generate electricity for things like air conditioning, preparing meals, heating water, and freezing their food in
right.
the process of making it.
So you're trying to the Army was trying to create an environment that was relatively comfortable or more comfortable than normal. Like you say, it was the units had air conditioning, which I'm sure you needed there.
Absolutely.
I mean, you couldn't do it without, but that required a lot of energy. You fed them well. Like you say, you had good refrigeration, secure refrigeration, and serve them everything from what their basic requirements to ice cream and stuff. So that required a lot of, and like you say, their energy was from diesel. How much diesel did you estimate was being consumed on a daily basis or so?
So the Marine Corps did a study on basing and came up with a number of 22 gallons per soldier per day. Now, that's the total amount of fuel transported into theater. But as I said before, very little of it was actually for tactical operations. About 75% of it went to air conditioning.
So that's massive amounts of fuel that has to get transported into these bases.
Because it wasn't Iraqi oil that was being converted to diesel, right? Because their refineries were
correct,
down.
Especially early on, but throughout. And of course, the Iraqis had to support their own needs for their civilian activities and for their military activities. So that was fuel above and beyond that was really transported into theater for the purpose that we used it.
And you said at some point, not only is it shipped in, then trucked in, it was actually sometimes it was flown in.
That's really in Afghanistan
for
the period when Pakistan shut down the Khyber Pass. They for a time had to fly. Fuel in to run generators, which is really not the way we would like to do business.
Because no. There's a level of inefficiency there.
Absolutely.
Okay. Really, that's the challenge.
Really, running generators on diesel is not a sustainable process anyway. And very rarely do you find a community that would do such a thing because it's expensive and that diesel fuel is in competition with transportation needs and other things. So it's really not commonly done. But in setting up the infrastructure in theater, what was important was efficacy or the ability to get the mission done. And efficiency really wasn't a primary concern, as you can imagine, in the middle of a war.
Right. You deal with – that's a lower level issue on the checklist of things to do or watch for. So all right. So that's the fuel use, 22 gallons per soldier per day. Tens or hundreds of thousands of shoulders. You're talking millions and millions of gallons of fuel, like you say, that have to be brought in, convoyed. There's obviously risk associated with just with, transporting this fuel around. So we'll get to that, what some alternatives or options or levels of efficiency that you're exploring in a minute. Let's talk about water. How much – that's another precious –
yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And large areas of Iraq and Afghanistan are arid and really don't have water available locally. And again, the local populace needs water. So to a great extent, we trucked bottled water over land at the same cost as the diesel, which comes out to about 7 gallons of fuel to transport 1 gallon of water or fuel to the point of use.
Wow. Okay. Seven to one. So it's just to move water around. And again, there's convoys of water trucks, I assume, that
are
moving around. And they are also at risk. So war is fought on, full stomachs, but in addition to, fuel and electrons and water.
Absolutely.
You got to get it around.
Absolutely.
Okay, so there's the Army's challenge. going forward? What were some of the lessons learned, or what are some of the things you're trying to apply?
So at Department of Defense level and at Department of the Army level, they've seen this as a major problem. And if we ever have to do something like this again, we really need to do a better job from the beginning to set the conditions to avoid or at least to reduce the level of this logistics effort that's required for soldier support. And so what they've done is really this requires culture change. It's not a technological fix where we can just buy something and throw it at the problem. We have to change the culture. Commanders and leaders need to understand where their power is coming from, the effort that's expended to get fuel to them, and then they kind of need to understand how to use the resources most efficiently in order to avoid waste, because every bit of waste is more stuff that has to get trucked into theater.
It's similar to the conversations that we have on a weekly basis here. You know, yeah. What is it that we can do to cut down on our energy use in our day-to-day lives? I'm sure there are some similar things.
Right.
But what are some of those energy efficiencies that you might see at a base?
Well, so there are many of them. It's as simple as getting soldiers to turn off the air conditioning when they leave for work in the morning.
Yeah.
You know,
familiar. That's a familiar
take
tune.
Shorter showers.
Right.
And other things like that. But what we've really done is, in pursuit of culture change, at West Point, we've taken our 30 core courses that all the cadets have to take and linked a number of them together into an interdisciplinary initiative to try to get at this from a number of directions. One of the big challenges in education is to get people to transfer knowledge from one course into another course and into their daily lives. And so what we've tried to do is engage energy. And I teach the general chemistry course for two semesters, so I really have freshmen as my population. Rather than a broad discussion of energy in a geopolitical sense, we confine it to the forward operating base and then the infantry squad as a discussion that's manageable and small enough that we can get to things. And then we haven't tortured our courses to get these topics in. What we've done is take the topics that we should cover or have to cover in a general chemistry course, and where there's an energy connection, we use that connection to illustrate the material that we have to cover anyway. So, for instance, at one point in our course, we calculate based on the amount of energy necessary to support a soldier for quality of life, we back calculate to how much fuel is going to be required to support that soldier for his year in theater. Comes out to about 10,000 gallons of diesel fuel for one soldier for a year.
Okay. But then you also then have to figure out, let's say if you're trying to establish a forward position, how much fuel has to be brought, how many trucks, vehicles are required to do that, what's the manpower associated just to get that. So it becomes a real word problem to try to
right.
get your head around just to establish forward positions.
Absolutely.
Fuel, water, energy, just to get things going.
Absolutely. But in a general chemistry course, you know, we try to avoid that. We do – so we turn 10,000 gallons into 4 2,500-gallon tactical fuel tankers and then have a reflection. But the point of the course is not how many trucks it's going to be. The point of the course is thermodynamics and the amount of energy contained in diesel fuel versus the amount a soldier needs.
Right. But there might be other courses that address logistics.
Absolutely.
And that was going to be my next question. Yeah. What's being worked into some of the other classes on campus?
So the information technology course that the freshmen have to take, they pull metered data from the cadet barracks and they have to turn 22,000 data points into something that they can visualize and see and then reflect on when usage is highest, when it's lowest, and what sorts of activities might be contributing to energy usage by time. In the psychology course, they talk about decisions and what goes into the decisions that people make and why they make them. Also, they go into a leader's ability to influence subordinates to do the right thing when they wouldn't naturally do so. So that's gets right after the cultural change.
That's the behavior change. They have to learn to compel,
right?
As future officers, compel their soldiers, their men to understand the value
absolutely
of energy efficiency, of turning those lights off
so
before you go out outside the wire.
Absolutely. So another challenge is at the squad level then for a dismounted squad going outside the wire to conduct operations. And this is more of a reality in Afghanistan, but it was also the case in Iraq. They go out for three-day patrols. And to support a three-day patrol, to be able to talk on their radios, to use their GPS and all the other amazing electronics that they have that make them much more effective, they carry on average about 14 pounds of batteries per soldier, which does nothing. You know, that's not socks, not food, not water, and not ammunition. It's batteries. And this is a problem because soldier loads have never been as high as they are, and they're climbing mountains and everything right. else with 80-pound-plus rucksacks.
Woo.
So
yeah,
one of the efforts then has been to field a system called SWIPE, Soldier Worn Integrated Power Equipment System, that links all of the big energy-demanding items together, and then they run off of a battery that's about the size of an iPad and about twice as thick and a little bit heavier. It's a lithium-ion battery, 14.8 volts, and delivers 148 watt-hours. So it's about three times what a normal laptop battery for a regular laptop would do. And then they've got other equipment that allows them to recharge that. So they've got a 60-watt solar blanket that's about the surface area maybe of a couch that they can unfold. If they're stationary during daytime in sunlight, they can get 50-plus watts of power to recharge that battery. And if you think in a tactical sense, if they're dismounted patrolling, there's a certain element of stealth to it. They'd rather be stationary in the daytime, and so it just makes tactical sense, too, that while they're stationary, they're recharging their power. So that cuts us from 14 down to about 9 pounds. And they're, of course, seeking ways to do better than that.
Wow. Okay. Hey, if you just joined us, we're speaking with Lieutenant Colonel Chip Elliott. He is a instructor of chemistry at the United States Military Academy at West Point. If you may have heard of the name Chip, when he was stationed in Iraq in 06-07, we'd call into KPCW almost every week and give a little update about his experiences there. And we're honored to have him here now to talk about some of the issues that he saw with respect to energy use, energy consumption, and now some of the challenges that he's bringing into his classroom to teach about energy efficiency.
One of the things I'm interested in is you mentioned these, you know, solar recharging systems that the soldiers can take with them when they go. Is there any talk of using solar technologies at bases?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So to really use it, if you think of the deployment in Iraq, which started with a high-intensity sort of conflict and then settled into to something else, if you don't own the stuff or have a plan to field it, you won't be able to get it done. Efficacy is the driver of everything, and so if generators are what you have, generators are going to be what you use. Absolutely, they are at Department of Defense and Department of the Army level. There's a significant operational energy effort to look at the appropriate mix of energy technologies for basing, and it's a contingency type of thing where not every place is suited to solar power, but certainly Iraq and Afghanistan were ideal places for us to have used it.
It seems like that level of self-sufficiency or creating power right on site also adds a little bit more like independence or security that you have that ongoing source.
Absolutely. Absolutely. One of the biggest liabilities that commanders faced is the logistical tail and the risk and the number of soldiers they put at risk to support that. So absolutely, if you had the ability to generate without having to transport fuel, you'd do a much better
and
job.
And smaller fuel depots.
Smaller fuel depots. Right. Everything gets smaller.
Every
soldier that you have deployed requires, you know, X percent of another soldier to support. And so to the extent you can reduce that, you get a cascading effect.
So how big are these bases and how many soldiers are, is this effort supporting or was it?
So the base I was on had 100 Americans. It was a small effort. Some of the bases are 20,000 or so. The bigger bases
right.
in theater were big.
Cities.
Like cities. Yeah. Absolutely.
Okay. So in the last few minutes, do you see that the Army is getting – you get it. You get the value of this. Do you see that the other that West Point, other professors and other courses are getting it and
absolutely
kind of intertwining this?
Absolutely. Both the cadets and the faculty have responded very well to the interdisciplinary initiative. We do this plebe capstone really with us, math, psychology, information technology courses, and then the EN 101 composition course. And when we ask the cadets afterwards how they felt about it, they are almost uniformly positive about the experience. There's really no cynicism in it, in their responses, both statistically and then in their free responses to it. They particularly love that they took this math course in modeling real-world situations and that they then get to apply it to a real-world situation where they have to make assumptions, they have to build a model, and then they have to support them from a from the impact of psychology of their soldiers and leaders and mm-hmm. and everything else.
Right. So now when the soldiers are, I can just picture them as they're heading out off base, they have their checklists. All right, I got my equipment, I got my armor, I got my safety thing, and did I turn the thermostat up in the barracks?
Exactly.
Right. Did you do
that? Right.
Gotta go.
And so it's not going to be a primary concern for them, so hopefully we can make it a habit for them.
Exactly.
Yeah. My food, my water. Did I turn the lights off?
That's right. Turn that on. Still on. So,
that's right.
No, that's great. And again, it's a risk issue. It's of course a budgetary issue.
Absolutely,
fuel's not cheap. It's not going to get any cheaper. So there's value across the board. And like Nella says, this is no different than the conversations we have with businesses and governments
sure.
who are addressing this issue of sustainability.
Sure.
Sustainability in the Army is really, really amazing. And maybe one day you'll get solar-powered tanks, hybrid tanks.
Yeah, that would be wonderful.
Imagine how quiet.
If we could swing that.
Yeah, exactly. That's a big panel. Well, Chip Elliott, we want to thank you so much for taking the time to join us and
thank
and
you
chat
very much
about what you're doing. Enjoy the rest of your week here.
Sure will.
You got some fresh snow, so good for you.
Absolutely.
All right. Let's take a break for some underwriters. And when we come back, we'll be on the line with our second guest, Emma Maris. And we'll go from there.
Sounds like a plan.
You got it now. It's This Green Earth. Stay tuned.
This is Chris Robinson with Prudential Utah Real Estate, and we've been supporting KPCW since day one. Prudential Utah helps buyers and sellers with their home needs, whether it's a condo, single-family house, or undeveloped land. Our agents know our community and our local market. More information can be found at pru-utah.com.
Hi, this is Reese DeMille with Republic Services, your local source for recycling and garbage services and a proud sponsor of KPCW's This Green Earth. Recycling in Summit County is improving. The trick to remember? Recyclable materials go in your larger blue or brown bin, and gray is for garbage. Recycling helps keep Summit County clean. SummitCountyRecycles.org.
Hi, I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Tim Henney. Join us for The Mountain Life Wednesdays at 9 a.m.
From the science of willpower to exploring the teenage brain.
From bike fit to relationship alignment.
From embracing imperfection to going gluten-free.
Join us for conversations with the experts on health, fitness, and lifestyle.
It's The Mountain Life Wednesdays at 9 a.m.
Brought to you by Utah Olympic Legacy Foundation.
Stein Erickson Lodge and Spa.
Park City Clinic.
Grand Valley Bank.
And Park Meadows Country Club.
Welcome back to This Green Earth. I'm Nell Larson, and that's Chris Cherniak mm-hmm. across the board. And joining us on the phone this morning is Emma Maris. She's the author of The Rambunctious Garden. And we'll talk with her about her book and also her view of conservation, land conservation in our current era, the Anthropocene. And also we'll mention her upcoming talk locally here in town. Emma, thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
So start by telling us about the title of your book. What does The Rambunctious Garden refer to?
So The Rambunctious Garden is meant to kind of bring up two different ideas. And one is to sort of come to terms with the human impact on the earth. It's not just, you know, much of the earth now is either farmed or it's been urbanized. And even the places that we consider wild are very carefully managed. So there's a sense in which the Earth has become a kind of a garden. But that's not necessarily what we want the whole Earth to look like. We want it to still have some kind of wild freedom. And that's where the rambunctious part comes in. We still can't, you know, kind of accurately or predict or know what we're doing. Nature is still too complicated for us to really control in any kind of intentional way. And there's still a lot of wildness out there. So this, sort of my vision of what the Earth is like today and what it's going to look like in the future, is this kind of rambunctious garden, this kind of hybrid between human influence and wild nature.
And this is something that you talk about in relation to a lot of different types of open spaces, some of which are sort of local community open spaces or parks.
Yeah. So, I mean, one thing that I think is interesting is that we're already doing a lot of intensive management of parks, both in sort of national parks, Yellowstone-type parks, and, of course, city parks, urban parks, parks on the periphery of suburban parks. But we tend to kind of sometimes ignore or not pay that much attention to that management because we have this emotional need for these areas to be kind of wild and self-willed. So part of what I was doing in the book was just drawing attention to the kind of management that's already going on.
Absolutely. I mean, it's something that I think about on a regular basis. Actually,
right.
I manage an open space here in town, the Swanert Preserve, and we want to manage for our water quality and we want to manage for our wildlife. And we want to, you know, try to keep the invasive species from taking over what we consider to be our native ecosystems. But there is no one pristine condition that we'll ever reach. And so how far do we go in trying to get
and
there?
How much energy and, of course, how much money is
right.
spent, time
right.
and effort, budget spent to try to, say, control invasives or exotics.
Right.
And or otherwise just allow them to kind of be a part in some small way,
right.
limited way,
yeah.
managed way. Is that
and
the
that's
idea?
Yeah. Well, that's a question that I'm trying to bring out into the open and to have an open discussion on. I mean, I do think that there is already a lot of really pragmatic management out there. And a lot of times people are doing, you know, what they can within the budgets of what they have. But I also think that sometimes we do cling to this kind of pristine baseline idea for certain spaces for which it might not be appropriate or even accurate, because a lot of times what we think of as the pristine condition was actually a product of totally human management. It just happened to be non-European humans. You know, if that's fine if we want to manage it to that condition, if we want to say, hey, let's bring it back to Native American management or let's bring it back to pre-European management. But to say that we're bringing that back to sort of the pristine state isn't necessarily that accurate. And in some cases, it may be that you could spend millions of dollars trying to take a small park back to a perfectly native state, and you'll never get there. But you could spend quite a bit less buying a bunch more land and managing to something that is still diverse and thriving and robust and something that people could enjoy and recreate in. So it's about balancing our goals and about thinking beyond backward-looking goals that are tied to history.
So in some cases, we might be, you know, putting the resources into maybe the wrong piece of land. Maybe focus on some land that's already, quote, wild.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, or just, you know, I mean, I have seen some projects that have been targeting non-natives that I think I would rather spend that money, yeah, just buying more land. Because some of these non-natives aren't actually that terrible. Some of them are pretty aggressive and can definitely cause changes in the landscape we don't like. But some of them just kind of show up and hang out.
Right.
And I guess I'm getting to this place as I see the world change so quickly and I see so many changes that if we cling to this idea of being super purist about every single non-native species, pretty soon there's not going to be any place left that we can really approve of. And we're going to
sure.
be left in a world that we consider trashy.
Right. So it's about how we think about it. Talk a little bit about your example of the Everglades.
Hmm.
Oh, right. So that became very controversial because of the invasive snakes that are in the Everglades.
Mm-hmm.
So these Burmese pythons are in there, and they are not benign. You know, they are actually actively eating a lot of native species.
Right.
So there's a lot of strong feelings about them. And there are derbies to catch and kill them and remove them. And occasionally, you know, Fish and Wildlife or some other agency will get one that's just massive and kind of horrifying. And I wrote a piece for Andy Rebkin's blog, .earth, where I just kind of said, well, look, two things. One is I've never met an ecologist who thinks that we can actually 100% eradicate these snakes from the Everglades. It's probably the cat is out of the bag, the toothpaste is out of the tube. It's going to be about control. So having said that, then, how should we feel about these animals when we see them out there? Should we hate them with this kind of fury? Or should we realize that the animals don't know where they are? They don't know they're in the wrong place. And they are spectacular animals. So all I try to assert there is that as we try to control them so that they don't mess up our native species, we shouldn't personally hate them. And we should maybe even feel lucky if we see one in the wild because they are magnificent creatures.
So what was, what was the pushback? Why was
it was
like, how dare you?
Kind of. And I mean, some of the pushback was that exact emotional, the emotional charge that I was trying to defuse a little bit, the sense that there is a war here between the natives and the non-natives and that, you know, we need to get those non-natives out. And that makes me uncomfortable, frankly. Who are we to say what date is the holy, pure date? And if you weren't in that ecosystem on that date, then you're the enemy. It's just all too loaded and emotional. Like I think we should be more kind of calm about these decisions and look about what are our conservation goals. You know, how can we achieve them?
Well, having lived in South Florida and have done work on some Everglades restoration, the Everglades lost their native definition decades ago when the Corps of Engineers went in and basically replumbed the entire place and allowed non-native vegetation to set up, et cetera. So the Everglades
It's
been through a lot, and snakes are just another chapter. And who knows, maybe the snakes are actually eating other non-native species, like all the iguanas in there, too. So
right. I mean, that is the case in another fascinating system in Hawaii, where they've got these non-native Chinese turtles in there, in Kauai. And the interesting thing with that system is that, A, these turtles are mostly eating other non-natives. And B, the turtles are endangered back in China. So if you eradicate all of these non-native Chinese turtles in the name of purity, you might actually be dooming that species to extinction. And so that creates an interesting tension.
Yeah, I mean, that's really interesting, especially when you sort of think of the changing habitats and the shifting habitats that we're seeing for species with climate change and with development.
Right.
Things are being forced to move. So if you find a place where something works, you know, who's to say whether or not that's a good fit?
Yeah, I think that what you said is, I mean, to me, this is, I think, where we're shifting. Like, you know, it's not always comfortable, and it's often kind of makes you feel confused and worried, and that's good because these are important issues. But I do feel that in the future, we're going to worry more about keeping things alive than we're going to worry about exactly where they are, that their existence will trump their native habitat.
Sure. If you are just joining us, we're speaking with Emma Maris, author of The Rambunctious Garden, and we're talking about conservation in our changing world today. One of the fascinating things that I read that you wrote, Emma, was about a debate that you ended up in with E.O. Wilson, a renowned writer and ecologist, and he you know, took you up on this concept, and he had a different feeling about it. So how did that conversation go?
So this was at the Aspen Forum in Colorado, and first of all, it was like it's just such an incredible honor to be on the same panel as this amazing man who I've been reading his work my whole life. I mean, absolute honor. And actually, the Everglades is what sparked the disagreement. The Everglades came up, and I kind of said, I made my little speech about how we shouldn't hate the pythons, and he asked me where was my white flag? Where is that white flag you're carrying? Because he saw this as surrender, as absolute surrender. And my response was not my own. It was words that I borrowed from a guy named Joe Mascaro, who's in my book. He was a grad student at the time and who was working on some non-native systems and who also was asked many times, why are you giving up? Why are you surrendering? And he said, look, I never took up arms. Like, this was not a battle that he ever signed up to fight, this battle for 1491 or in Hawaii, you know, when Captain Cook got there in the 1760s. You know, these are not dates that he ever felt were that important. He's interested in the global picture, I guess. So that was my response. It was a pretty short exchange, but definitely ruffled some feathers. And I can understand his point of view. We have such deep emotional attachments to these systems. They're not just a big collection of plants and animals. To us, they are places of sort of spiritual solace and places of great beauty. And seeing them kind of what seems to be unraveling is deeply painful. These seems like what I'm proposing seems to many like compromises. But my point of view is that if you see all of these changes as 100% negative, then you're going to be left with nothing. And more importantly, our children will be left with nothing that they can consider acceptable nature. They'll be left with nothing but weeds. And that's not fair to them. I think that it's better to say, look, nature is going to change in response to all of these forces that we've put upon it. And that change itself is nature sort of adapting and being beautiful. And if we can see it that way, then there will be some nature for our children.
I was thinking that what if instead of the python, moving into the Everglades, it was something more that had a better public relations. So, why not more
fuzzy and
bowerbirds or right. Western tanagers? Or would people have the same reaction to invasives if they were actually more appealing?
Yeah, I think that that kind of thing. And it also depends on what the system is. So when you have parakeets in San Francisco or something, people think it's charming.
Yes.
Because it's already an urban system, so people don't consider it nature, even though there's lots of plants and animals there. And it's a more appealing animal, right? And something as similar as something interesting, that kind of our emotional reaction to different species is playing out closer to where I live with the barred owl, spotted owl debate, which is very interesting. The Fish and Wildlife Service and some other groups are thinking about shooting barred owls because they are competing with the endangered spotted owl. And this just wicks everybody out. Like, nobody likes this, not even the people who are proposing it. And it's because they're owls, and owls are so charming.
Right.
So there's a lot of... And, the fact that we have all these emotional reactions with these species is ultimately, I think, a good thing, because it means that we have some connection to them that hopefully will help them be saved. But it does mean that we sometimes have different feelings about slithery creatures than we do about furry creatures.
Yeah.
Technical terms there.
More indigo buntings for me, please.
Right.
So, a lot of what you're saying does speak to our changing relationship with nature. And an article that you had written caught my eye. It's called Hipsters Who Hunt.
Yeah.
And will you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. Well, this was a piece that's probably gotten more play than almost anything I've ever written. And it was actually a pretty simple little premise. I had noticed that my friends in the East were surprised that members of my sort of circle of friends and family were hunters, but also kind of liberal kids with tight jeans. And these two kind of groups, hunters and sort of liberal urbanites, didn't overlap in the minds of many in the East. But there's plenty of them out there, and an increasing number, as many people who are starting to question the sort of industrial food system and how animals that are part of regular kind of high-intensity agriculture are treated, but they don't necessarily want to give up meat. One possible ethical alternative, and even Michael Pollan talks about this in his famous Omnivore's Dilemma, is to go out and hunt the stuff yourself. Then the animal spent its whole life out in sort of habitat that it's sort of happy in, and then just at the very last minute it's shot, and then you eat it. so it's in some ways there are plenty of people who are hunting because they see it as a more ethical way to eat meat. So it's an interesting movement, and it's one that I have personally benefited from by floods of delicious game that comes to my freezer from friends and family. So I'm all for it. I really am. I think it's a good way also for people who live in cities and maybe have a maybe more rose-colored view of the wilderness and nature to participate in nature in a kind of a more hands-on and gritty way, and I'm all for that as well too.
Well, I'm sure at least one of the counter arguments would have been, why are you hunting at all? Why are you even eating meat?
Right.
You don't need to even forage or kill your own food. Just have a vegetarian-based diet or something along those lines?
Yeah. But interestingly, there are a lot of populations that, for example, white-tailed deer in the east, there are a lot of animals out there that are not actually being very well controlled right now and are actually kind of problematic on the landscape. And in some places, Canada geese. In some places, there's even too many wild turkeys at the moment.
Yeah.
So in some cases, in places where we have pushed out the natural predators and they're not back yet, hopefully they'll be in a lot of more places before the century's through, hunting plays a necessary role in keeping those populations from going insane and eating all of the vegetation down to the ground.
Right.
So I think that it can be a very environmental act to hunt in certain species in certain seasons.
Yeah, I agree. Places. Certain species, like wild pig, too. Feral pigs are a huge issue.
Yeah. Hunting and eating problematic non-natives is also a very popular thing that's going on.
Yeah.
And depending on the non-native, some of those feral pigs can be super delicious. So also a promising environmental development.
Sounds like you have some experience with that.
Super delicious.
So, Emma, tell us a little bit about your background and how you got into this field and took up this topic that you're known for now.
So I grew up in Seattle, and like I said, I was kind of a classic urban liberal girl, very much interested in saving the old growth forest, and I had I'd say somewhat simplistic ideas about, nature is that thing that's out there, and it's perfect and pure and timeless. And then this city and all these places that aren't old growth forests are basically not nature. They're basically worthless. And then I went off and got a science writing degree, and I started working for the scientific journal Nature as a news reporter and following conservation, biology, and ecology as my beat. And so I would go to their conferences and go out with them in the field and interview them and write stories about their work. And the more time I spent with them, the more of these complexities started to appear to me, and the more confused I got about what was wilderness and what was nature and what are appropriate goals. And so eventually I decided that all that I had learned about these complexities and about some of these newer ways or more forward-looking ways of thinking about conservation, that was worth a book. So I decided to put together some of my experience and add some more experience and write a book. And it has turned out to be a definite conversation starter in the fields of conservation biology in particular. There's a lot of people who are really excited about the ideas in the book and who think that they capture a growing trend. There's also another group of people who find these ideas, like E.O. Wilson, they find them unpleasant. Mm. And so we've been having those conversations a lot.
Fantastic. Well, before we wrap up, I want to make sure to give our listeners the information for your upcoming talk at Utah State University. That is on the 26th. And what's the time?
I believe it's at noon,
Okay, it's at the 26th at noon, so if anyone happens to be in Logan, you can go catch Emma at a university-wide talk.
It's part of their Natural Resources Week.
Fantastic.
Oh, great.
So there may be other activities that you can sort of tack on to your trip there.
Right.
Before we let you go, where can we read more of what you've written and find out more about you?
Well, I do have a website, which is just my name, emmamaris.com, and there's two R's in Maris. So check it out there, and I try to post new articles that I write. And there's also a page there with links to the book and some of the other books that I've contributed to.
Fantastic.
Emma Maris, thank you for taking the time to chat with us this morning.
Oh, I enjoyed it so much. Thank you so much.
All right. Hey, let's take a break for a few underwriters, and when we come back, we'll have some news items and a talk to come tonight at Swanner. We'll talk about that. It's This Green Earth. Stay tuned.
Hi, this is Steve Roney with Prudential Utah Real Estate, a proud supporter of KPCW. With more than 100 sales associates and 14 gallery or ski-in offices in Park City, Prudential Utah can help you with your residential or commercial real estate needs. More information at prud-utah.com or with the Prudential Utah mobile search app.
Hi, this is Alyssa Daly with Republic Services, your local recycling and garbage pickup provider and proud sponsor of KPCW's This Green Earth. All-in-one recycling is used in Summit County. Recyclables go in your larger blue or brown bin, and gray is for garbage. Recycling helps keep Summit County clean. SummitCountyRecycles.org.
Join KPCW every weekday morning from 6 to 8 a.m. for the latest news in town and around the world. Trusted news anchor Leslie Thatcher delivers local news as well as broadcasts of NPR News, Marketplace, and national stories. Morning Edition with Leslie Thatcher, sponsored by Promontory the Ranch Club, Nexus IT, Jan's Mountain Outfitters, and Deer Valley Resort.
Welcome back to This Green Earth, weekly talk show on environmental issues and concepts of sustainability and what is pristine nature and what is not.
These are hard questions.
They are hard questions.
If not impossible.
But that's what we do here on the show. We try to at least
tackle the big
broach
issues.
Them. But we got some other items and some news to talk about. First, we want to do let's get to the talk tonight.
Sure. So tonight at 7 p.m. at the Swanner Eco Center, we are hosting a Summit County air quality panel. And air quality is obviously something that we talk a lot about in this area, but primarily as it relates to Salt Lake. And so we're really going to focus on Summit County itself. And so we've got Larry Warren, actually. KPCW's own Larry Warren is the moderator of the event. And we'll be speaking with four different panelists who are going to look at different angles of this. So Cameron Kova, who's at the JD with Breathe Utah, is covering sort of politics and the legislative side of air quality, what might work, what's currently happening, and what just happened in this recent session. We'll be speaking with Tim Henney from the Park City Council, and he's going to be talking about the recreation and tourism side, how that's being impacted by air quality.
Right.
We will hear from Carrie Kelly, who's a research associate at the U of U Department of Chemical Engineering. We actually spoke with her on the show a few months ago about her recent research about where this particulate matter is coming from. And so she's going to kind of cover the science of the air quality issue in this area. And then finally, Dr. Brian Mensch, he's the president of Utah Physicians for a Healthy Environment. And he'll be speaking about the impact on our health of air quality and how that impacts us and in what ways.
Wow.
So we've got a good panel together, and we'll also be looking at some of the research that's been produced here in Summit County on our air quality by Rich Bulla and others at the health department.
Wow, fantastic.
Yeah, great lineup.
I love that
enthusiasm.
When is this happening? I wasn't listening.
So now I've got your attention. It's at 7 p.m. tonight at the Swanner Eco Center. And this event is it's in partnership with Park City Municipal. So Swanner and Park City put it on together. And it's the third year that we've done an event like this together. We try to take something that's like a pretty big issue that's getting a lot of attention or concern and bring it down to the local level and answer some of the local questions that are relevant to us here in Park City and Summit County.
Well, yeah. What is the source of our poor air up here at times? Is it cars? Is it fireplaces? Is it all of the
natural
gas?
Is it the highways
fire?
Running through the county? Is it
exactly? So this is localizing the issue.
Yeah, is it coming up the canyon? That's a question that we've heard a lot. Is the Salt Lake Valley inversion reaching us? Is that pollution impacting our
Are we
quality?
Seeing more inversions?
That's
which
right.
is a question for Brian McInerney.
Who you'll have on?
Who will be next week's
next
guest?
Next week.
That's poor air is a function of inversions. Are we seeing more inversions too? Okay, so there's lots of issues. Great, good thing. I'm gonna go to that. Thanks, Nell, for talking about.
You are welcome.
And that
kind
of segues into at least one of the stories I wanted to get to is Paris had a bad air episode. They had their own inversion, and over this period of days, their air got worse and worse. You see some images of that.
Yeah, I mean, this was like big on the international news level.
Yeah. So what did they do? They banned driving Monday for cars registered with, I think it was an odd number or so, So half the cars effectively were banned from driving. And now you could drive. If you had, your number was registration number was such that you weren't supposed to, you could still drive, but you risked a $30 penalty. And apparently, they put the ban into effect Monday morning. 4,000 motorists were pulled over and fined for driving.
Okay.
So that's $30. So, But they did see a reduction in or an improvement in air quality in just one day of banning. They saw a 60% reduction in traffic.
Wow.
Just, you know, kind of on average.
Yeah.
So a lot of people in Paris, you know, kind of abided by the request to not drive. Now, the problem is over because a weather system came through and has kind of blown the bad air out, and you know, and the air is much better now.
But has this happened? You know, what's the history of this happening?
The last time they grounded cars because of pollution was in 1997. So
okay.
it's infrequent.
Yeah.
But this is how Paris and the Parisians address the issue. Could, you know, is that something that we would do here in the Salt Lake Valley?
Yeah.
No.
No, we would. I don't think
it would
we
be
would
voluntary.
Ever do that.
It's voluntary. I already have that set on red
exactly.
days. It's voluntary not to drive or drive less.
Right.
That's the extent of our request.
I saw some shocking images of the Eiffel Tower and the smog. You know, it was impressive. Do we know how their air quality is compared with ours in Salt Lake?
No, I didn't look into that. I mean, it was a pretty bad, you know, a red day, you know, a hazardous day. Or so that they had that required this effort. And the other thing was, in addition to banning cars, their public transportation was free.
Ah, that's big.
That played a big role too. So that's the air quality issue in Paris.
And also, I believe that cars with at least three passengers were exempted from the measure. So carpooling.
So maybe we can talk about bring this up tonight. Is this an option?
Right.
That could make a difference. Or even be pursued by state regulators, state legislatures. So that's the one issue. Let's see. We got a couple more minutes. What's on tomorrow's show?
So tomorrow on The Mountain Life, which is every Wednesday with Tim and Lynn, they are going to be talking about Oral Health Week. And as Lynn has written here, did you know that? Did you know that even existed?
You know, I've missed it again.
Well, this year you'll be on top of it.
For at least half the week.
Okay. That's right. So you start flossing. Steve Escott from Trails Mix in Moab, the trails organization down south, will be on to talk about how they build and fund all the multitude of trail networks found down there. And then they have a third guest.
Of course.
Annabelle Gurwitch, who's a comedian, author, and actress, and she'll be talking about turning the big 50.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, here's the deal.
Do you have some advice?
It's not funny. There's nothing funny about it. Good
Maybe
luck
Maybe you
her.
Need to listen to this interview.
We'll listen to the show. Okay. You know what? We got to take one more break for last Runder Writers and come back and wrap up. It's The Screener. Stay tuned.
The Utah Olympic Park offers winter outdoor adventure for all abilities. The guided adventure experience is a fun-filled way to build skills and enjoy outdoors as you weave through a ropes course and balance on moving features. Our experienced guides personalize the adventure for every participant. The guided adventure is available at 1 p.m. or 3 p.m. Wednesdays through Saturdays. Reservations required. Info and rates are available at UtahOlympicLegacy.com. Utah Olympic Park is a nonprofit organization dedicated to providing sport and recreation opportunities.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided by Longrimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, LRW-LAW.com. Brett Stimson, Mortgage Assistant for Home Purchases, 801-201-3484. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners like you.
Welcome back to This Green Earth. It's time to wrap up another interesting show. Thanks again to Lieutenant Colonel Chip Elliott from the United States Military Academy coming by, talking about energy and fossil fuels and what the military is doing about those things. Really interesting.
And something that we don't hear very much about. You never hear about what the military is thinking about there.
Yeah. But it's something they have to deal with every day. And also thanks to Emma Maris.
That's right, the author of Rambunctious Garden, for joining us over the phone. And she'll be talking at Utah State University later this week.
And, of course, always thanks to our underwriters for whom this show would not be possible. They include Jones, Waldo, Holbrook, and McDonough, Republic Services,
Habitat for Humanities Restore,
Vail Resorts,
Rocky Mountain Power,
San Francisco Design,
and Prudential Utah Real Estate.
And of course, you can join us on Facebook, KPCW, This Green Earth. Green Earth. Like us there.
That's right. And we're always looking for your requests and suggestions for what to cover on the show. You can email us at thisgreenearth@kpcw.org.
This is KPCW 91.9 FM, Park City.
Only in Park City, only on KPCW.
NPR News is next.